News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday afternoon here on KMJ. And remember, now we're on AM and FM. You hear us on AM 580 at 1 p.m. and then on FM 105.9 every Saturday at 5 p.m. Each week, we visit with World War II veterans. The idea is really threefold. First of all, we want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We also want to preserve their stories so they're not forgotten and so the rest of us know what kind of price has been paid for our freedom. And along the way, I think we all learn a thing or two. And there's one place here in the Valley, there's a few of them, but one place that's done a tremendous job of preserving history, educating our future. And it's easy to forget about what a treasure we have right under our nose. That's Castle Air Museum. And this week's program, as well as next week's, will come from Castle Air Museum. You're going to hear from some veterans who had a hand in not just aircraft in World War II, but some other endeavors as well. But we're going to start out to give you a little taste of what you're missing if you haven't been to Castle Air Museum in a while. I'm joined by Castle Air Museum's Executive Director, Joe Pruzzo. Joe, this museum's been here for a long time. I mean, people remember the Air Force Base here. I grew up remembering how to dive under the desk because the Russians were going to bomb Merced County because we had all the B-52s at Castle Air Force Base. But since the base closed, getting traffic to the museum, is that a challenge sometime to get everybody here and remind them that this place is here?
Well, you know, Paul, it has been a challenge, and we have tried to branch out, be more active in the Fresno market, Sacramento, Stockton, and hopefully over to the Bay Area. But getting them here, since we are a little bit off the beaten path, we're about a mile or a mile and a half off Highway 99. And if you'll notice on the way up, we do have a large billboard just north of Madera on 99 and one at the Buhack Road exit, which leads you directly to the museum off 99. So we're trying to get better signage on 99 with all of that north and southbound traffic and make them aware that the museum is here and it's a national treasure to come see. Currently 55 vintage aircraft dating from pre-World War II on up through current, and that's growing. And not only Air Force aircraft, Navy aircraft, we've got an accreditation now with the Army, so hopefully we'll see some Army helicopters coming soon. But it's definitely an educational experience, and it's really hallowed ground to be able to come out and see some of these treasures that quite literally are very few left in existence. You're going to talk to someone about a B-24. Over 18,000 built today, there's probably about 15 known in existence. So one of which is right here, the only B-24 in the whole state of California.
Yeah, and that B-24 sits prominently here. I look forward to hearing some of those stories. I remember coming out here for a TV special and burning up in the cockpit of a B-29 when it was 100 degrees outside. And that's one of the fun things you guys do every year is Open Cockpit Day. How long do we have to wait for that?
Well, that comes up Memorial Day weekend in May, and then also we do it now on Labor Day weekend. It's the Sunday on Memorial Day weekend and also the Sunday on Labor Day weekend. So twice a year we do an open cockpit, and it's really quite an experience to be able to open up and look inside of these airplanes and get a perspective from the veterans and the people who crew chief them out here at the museum.
I'm glad you mentioned that. We're talking to Joe Pruzzo, Executive Director of Castle Air Museum. We'll hear from a World War II veteran here shortly. But Joe, you mentioned the people who keep these planes in the shape that they're in so people can see what it was really like when these planes were actually flying. How big of an army of volunteers is that? And aren't a lot of them guys that actually dealt with those planes or similar planes at one point in the service?
Yes, they are. We have a volunteer corps, probably active and inactive volunteers of about 200. When I mentioned crew chiefs, they're the people that wash the airplanes, inspect them for any corrosion or you know, weed around them, things like that, to keep them presentable as an exhibit. And I have to also credit the restoration volunteers, many of which were in the military, some of which were not now. We're seeing some younger people come aboard, and we're very, very thankful for that. Because without the volunteers, and I guess I also want to talk about docents, tour guides, and people who just work special events, a lot of people don't realize that this museum is not supported by the government or by the Air Force or anybody. It's a nonprofit museum. So their admission dollars, the dollars we raise on special events like Open Cockpit Day, go directly to grow and maintain the museum. Without the volunteers, there would be no museum. I will tell you that. We have a very, very small staff, which is which wears a lot of hats on the day-to-day operation to keep it going.
And if somebody's listening, I know we have a lot of guys listening who are in the Air Force or in one branch of the military or another over the years, and sometimes they say, you know what, I'd like to go fiddle around with one of those old planes again sometime. Are you looking for more volunteers? If somebody wants to come out and help you, can they do that?
Absolutely. We're looking for our volunteers 24/7 for restoration, for docenting, tour guiding, working special events. Restoration, of course, is here the most. They're here 3 days a week. And we need people in sheet metal repair, painting, people who are knowledgeable and can and want to learn. We definitely welcome them. And if they're interested, please call our office here at 209-723-2178. And typically Monday through Friday, there's someone here that can answer those questions or have them come in and sign up. We'd love to have them.
All right, that's 209-723-2178. I'll also have that number on our website at kmjnow.com, where you can link to the Castle Air Museum website, see some pictures of these great airplanes. If you've never been to the Castle Air Museum, I hope you'll make that your New Year's resolution. Bring your family. It's a great place for people of all ages. And if you haven't been here in a long time, maybe you want to make that your New Year's resolution too, because you guys have a few new items here, don't you, Joe?
We have quite a few new items, exhibits, a Air Force F-15. We have the Navy F-14 Tomcat, F-8 Crusader, and some other naval aircraft currently under rework and restoration. Also, there's a lot of new exhibits downstairs. We've celebrated the 100th anniversary of Naval Aviation, so the Indoor Museum also has a lot of artifacts and things like that to see. But our growth has been phenomenal, and it's due to the volunteers from going to retrieve an aircraft, disassemble it, and we thankfully have a corporate sponsor that it's in the harvesting business. To the north of us in Turlock, that hauls these aircraft for us from diverse places for no charge as a donation. So that's huge. That's $10,000, $20,000 gifted to us for that.
I've got one more question for you, Joe. And again, if you're listening at home, I hope you'll make it out here to the Castle Air Museum. We'll talk more about it next week, and we'll hear from somebody who's actually served in one of these fine airplanes here in just a moment. I've got to ask you, though, Joe, because when you have more than four dozen airplanes, you probably get asked this a lot. What's your favorite as someone who's here every day? And when we come by on the road, we see the supersonic SR-71 Blackbird jumped right out at you. The World War II people love to see the big bombers. But what about you? Do you have one exhibit, one airplane here that is just your personal favorite?
Boy, that is really a tough question. I would have to say they're all my favorite to one extent or another. I get directly involved with helping restoration locate some parts and things like that. So for me, it's a labor of love, either way you cut it. From fundraising, we're constantly raising funds. But an aircraft, my favorite aircraft, I've always gravitated toward the bombers, but it's a tough one. I tell you, they're all my favorite. So I'd have to pick all 50, or, well, soon to be 60, I guess.
You don't want to upset the B-17 guys by saying B-24? Is that what this is all about?
I'm trying to be politically correct here, so I don't want to get to... Every airplane has unique and special traits to it and really contributed a great deal to the defense of our freedom and is a tribute to the men and women who designed, built, maintained, and flew the airplanes. You know, we talk about a lot of times pilots are important, but as Ed here, who is a navigator, I've talked to some navigators, and they say, well, no, we're the most important person because we tell pilots where to go. So, you know, with Castle Air Force Base, I've always had a love or an affinity for the B-52, especially for its longevity of service. You know, Castle, as you may be aware, in 1955 was the first recipient of the B-52. And when the base closed in 95, carried that mission until that day. So B-52s still flying, the latter version, the H model with the turbofan engines. Again, you know, first flew in the early 1950s and is expected to be flying until, 2040. So, you know, American taxpayer definitely got their bang for the buck out of that airplane. It's really quite remarkable, and I do miss seeing them fly around, that and the tankers, the KC-135s. That's what this base was really all about, and what a lot of people don't realize is it was also a training base. Every member of the Air Force that was associated with the B-52 or the KC-135 tanker flowed through Castle. So you get about 40 years of air crew flow through here. So quite phenomenal.
And there really is no end to the history that you could uncover if you visit Castle Air Museum here in Atwater. Joe, I was about to tease what's coming up next with Ed Nacy, but since you've known him longer than I have, maybe I should let you do that. He's a guy that you folks at Castle Air Museum have known quite well over the years. He's given a lot of his time here. Before I ask him some tough questions about his time in the U.S. Army Air Corps, why don't you tell me what you've appreciated most about him over the years?
Well, I appreciate Ed as a person. I appreciate his candor, his generosity, a very giving individual and a very knowledgeable individual. And Ed, I've really appreciated his input and his knowledge. I mean, Ed was not only a navigator on the B-24, but later went on to serve in the Strategic Air Command and the Pentagon. So he's a very talented individual, and we're very, very fortunate to have him.
All right. Well, we're going to hear some of his stories when we come back. You're listening to Hometown Heroes on KMJ.
A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, coming to you this week from Castle Air Museum in Atwater, California. If you've never been, you ought to. Make that your New Year's resolution. Get on out here to Castle Air Museum. See some of the more than 55 aircraft that have been restored, are in great condition for you to come walk around. And if you do, you might be surprised. If you've seen footage of a B-24, when you come see one in person, you might be surprised by how big it really is, because I think it does take on a larger-than-life mentality. And we're going to talk to someone who can tell us, because he had 32 missions in him as a navigator during World War II. Ed Nacy, 89 years old, joins me now. And Ed, you grew up in the bitter cold weather of Duluth, Minnesota. So was getting in the military a way to get out of there, or what?
No. Pearl Harbor came along, and that was a big factor and stuff. So as soon as I went into the Army Air Corps.
Well, I want to ask you about that. That's one thing I like to ask every veteran that's on the show, because everyone seems to have a specific memory about December 7th, 1941. Where were you, and how did you hear about it?
Well, I was in Duluth, and I had the flu. I was laying on the Davenport and had the flu, and at the time didn't know where Pearl Harbor was, but I found out very quickly what it is and stuff, so yeah.
Did it hit you at that point, how significant an event in world history this was, and how it might change your future as well as many others?
Yes, it did. And most of my high school buddies and stuff were about ready to go into the Marines, and they were forming an arrowhead platoon that was going to be with the Marines, and I was going to go along with them. But I didn't go, because my father worked in the steel plant, and he was a crane operator, and he was seriously injured and had to go in the hospital. So that delayed me. And that's how I happened to wind up in the Army Air Corps instead of the Marines. And I think about that many times, because most of my buddies, high school buddies that went into the Marines, many of them were in Tarawa and Iwo Jima and all. And I lost some of my high school buddies in those two operations. So I've thought about that many times. I wasn't in the Marines, and I was in the Army Air Corps and survived. So that was a fluke of circumstance, I guess you could say. Otherwise, I might have been in the Marines.
And you wouldn't have been here talking to me right now.
That is correct.
Well, I'm glad it worked out the way it did. And something tells me, if you enlisted by your own volition into the Army Air Corps, that you probably wanted to be a pilot. Is that safe to say?
Yeah, absolutely right. One of my big disappointments that I've kept for many, many years, over 50, 60 years and stuff. I washed out of pilot school after I had 33 hours of flying time on a spot check. I hated second lieutenants ever since then because one of them washed me out. So I got over it and stuff and went to navigation school and survived as a navigator. And I've often wondered if I had survived as a pilot because I was in class 44A, and a lot of my friends were in that 44A class and didn't survive. So that wanted to be a P-51 pilot, and after now all those years, I have finally adjusted to that loss.
Well, again, it might be one of the reasons that you're still here and can tell your story. And I'm sure you have a few stories to tell, 32 missions as a navigator on B-24s. But tell me about the first time that you got in one of those airplanes, because, you know, as guys who fly B-17s or B-29s would certainly tell us, they're not much to look at. Flying Anvil is not the most kind nickname that could be bestowed on an airplane. What was your impression the first time that you stepped foot on a B-24?
Awkward to get around in and to do navigation, and you have limited accesses. And I've told many people that I happened to be in the Ford economy version of the bombers, and the B-17s was the Cadillac of the bombers, and we've always compared them. And so I was in an airplane that probably went through the mill and was built in 1 hour, I think, as Ford Motor ran them through their assembly line and stuff. But it was a good airplane and had better engines than the B-17, and it brought me back home all the time.
Well, that's the hallmark. It could really take a beating, and I'm sure you probably learned that firsthand by some of the anti-aircraft artillery you faced, maybe even fighters you faced. Tell me about getting over to England and getting ready to fly. You had a 10-man crew on that plane, I assume?
That's right. Yes, it's kind of interesting that you ask that part of it, because you mentioned something about North Dakota, and I came into the Air Force and from Duluth and got on a train in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I made a good friend from Bismarck, North Dakota. Mm-hmm. And we went through the whole program as friends, including going to all. He washed out of pilot school. We both went to navigation school. We graduated from navigation school, were assigned to B-24s, and went overseas together in B-24s, flew across the North Atlantic, and landed at Nuts Corner, Ireland, and we were still friends. And we went from there, we went over to the Stone Wales, which is the dispersal area for, we were combat crew replacements and stuff. And at that point, his pilot went to one group, and my pilot went to another group. And as it turns out, my pilot was, I don't know whether he drew out of a lot or a hat or what, but that was the 93rd. And my good friend, John Brandenburg, was assigned to the 492nd Bomb Group, both B-24 groups. We flew missions together, and I remember one specific mission at Politz on 20th June of 1944. That's the first time I ever really, not the first, but it's the most memorable time when I saw nine B-24s shot down and hit the water over the Baltic Sea. The group, the 93rd that I was with, one of them, the airplanes that we went through training with, was shot up pretty bad and went to Sweden to recover and unfortunately crashed. But we survived that one and flew back home. Quite a bit of damage, but survived.
Well, and just you telling that story, I'm sure everybody listening at home is saying, okay, if you see nine airplanes that happen to be the same exact aircraft you're flying go down, that kind of sends a message about your own expendability and potential demise. I mean, how do you see that happen and not think, you know what, I could be next?
Yes, that does. Although everything happens so fast, you don't dwell on that and stuff. Because after Politz, we went to Berlin. And so that was another mission that had several serious losses and stuff in previous missions and stuff. But kept going, and we flew almost every other day sometimes when after D-Day and all. So we were busy, and the only time we really were shot up pretty bad was in Montereau, France, in case that we were the lead airplane was hit by anti-aircraft and had to go in, and we were right next to them, and so we were also hit and had a lot of flak damage, and the pilot was hit, and the co-pilot was hit, and radio operator was hit. Now, I was in the nose, and I had flak in my desk, but didn't no injury and stuff, and the nose gunner panicked and opened up his hatch and stuff, and then blew my maps all over, but I was able to give instructions to the pilot and headings, and the one pilot was injured on the right side, but he was able to stay in the seat, and the co-pilot had to be replaced because we had a bombardier who had flying time, so he moved in where the co-pilot was, and the pilot flew us back, and we made an emergency landing down in southern England, Beachy Head. Like always, when you have those things, you had to have shoot-off red flares when you have injured on board and stuff. And we landed there, an emergency landing, and it took the pilot and the co-pilot off and the radio operator and stuff, and the rest of us, we stayed overnight. We had to stay overnight. They fed us, and then I remember sleeping there because that's when the buzz bombers were coming over in England, and they were trying to shoot them down, and they had aircraft and also other fighters. And I remember for a residue from those anti-aircraft, we were in those Quonset huts and tin roofs and stuff, and you could hear that stuff coming down and hitting your top of your roof and stuff. Anyway, that they sent back another crew down, another pilots, and flew us back home. Flew about five more missions. You mentioned being scared. After I'd seen what flak could do very visibly, my next mission, the other mission was to Kiel. I remember that one. I could really feel it there. Finished that one back home, and since we lost those two pilots and the rest of the crew survived, they said that's considered a combat tour, and they completed it and stuff. So they said, you're ready to be sent back home for further assignment. So I did. Interestingly, I was sent home on the Queen Mary. Winston Churchill came on board. And so we had to make a special trip back home, and it took 13 days. And so, but we had escort and submarines and air escort and all that sort of thing. But Winston Churchill and his party got off in Halifax for meetings with the president. So came on home and went on for further processing, the next assignment, which was considered to be the Pacific next turn.
Well, I want to come back to that, but I want to hear more about this mission, because I'm sure you've told the story a few times, and since you have, you told it very matter-of-factly, but I'm trying to imagine myself as you, and here you are, a 22-year-old kid, navigating this plane, and people now don't identify with maps in the cockpit or in the nose of a plane because it's all computerized. This was not the case in 1944. So the guy opens the hatch, your maps blow everywhere, your pilot, your co-pilot, all these guys are wounded. It sounds pretty chaotic. How did you stay focused, and how did you keep your head on straight in that situation?
Well, you do what had to be done. And so I had to go back, and I actually helped with, they were giving first aid to the pilot that had been hit. And then I helped the bombardier get into the seat and the radio operator, and we were all doing what had to be done. So it wasn't hard. I knew exactly the direction to go, and so we just descended down and started making emergency movement back to the base and stuff. So
it didn't, not having the pilots that you were used to, didn't cause any kind of panic or distrust or concern.
No, the pilot, even though he was injured on the right side, his left hand, he was there and he was able to do it, and the other bombardier that moved into the pilot seat was able to help and stuff. And it was what you do, what you had to be done. That's what it boiled down to.
Well, I'm going to take a wild guess here, because I know that you're the recipient of a Distinguished Flying Cross. Did it have anything to do with that mission?
No, I don't think, not specifically. Okay. It's completing a tour and then air medals for a certain number of missions and so forth. Yeah, so not specifically that one. There's many many stories of the 8th Air Force and lost a lot of airplanes. So this is just another one of those experiences that were at the 8th Air Force.
On that mission or on others, how close did you come to thinking, you know what, we might have to ditch, we might have to bail out of this bomber, I don't think this plane's going to get us back?
I think probably when we came back after that mission where I saw those nine 9B-24s hit the water, we had to head back home. It was a long haul over the North Sea back to East Anglia, so it was long. And we had damage and stuff, and also there was some concern, I think, that we'd have to ditch or something. And I knew that the B-24 was not a good airplane for ditching. B-17 was better, but the B-24 was not.
And why is that? Explain that to us. Why?
Just the design of the airplane, yeah. The B-17 has the great big wing and stuff, and the B-24 has a narrow wing called the Davis wing. And that's one of the reasons they made that airplane successful, because it was faster and had more capability, longer range and stuff. So, but the B-24, there's a battle all the time between the B-24 and the B-17. Most of us think the B-17's got all the publicity, which they did, but we were actually the better airplane and flew more missions in a larger variety of areas, as an air refueling submarine serviced across the hump and so forth. We did a larger variety of missions. It was longer range and stuff. So.
Well, and I think Liberator is kind of a more noble name than Flying Fortress, too, don't you?
Oh, I love it. I love it. That's why it's so important that it's parked right here in front of the museum at Castle Air Museum and stuff. So.
Well, I was wondering, in all the tours that you've given here over the years, do you get any of that B-24 propaganda out there and make sure that the people taking the tours think more highly of the B-24 than the B-17?
I probably do once in a while, get a special little dig in for that and all. But, yeah, it's kind of standard among a lot of the people that flew both airplanes. Yeah. So.
And you mentioned Winston Churchill coming aboard your ship when you're headed home from Europe. What was that like? Did you get close to him? What was the kind of the aura around him?
Yeah, the aura is looking back on it, just knowing that he was there. But it was he and his party. And they were obviously isolated. We were not restricted. We didn't get into it. But the interesting thing about that is it took 13 days to go make the crossing, because we were zigzagging and so forth to avoid the submarines and so forth. So I got home and I was fatter because I did a lot of eating, and on the deck with the sun and stuff. I got home to Minnesota, Duluth, and it was almost embarrassing in a way, because I looked so healthy and all, and having completed my tour, and a lot of the people that I was associated with said, my son was in Guadalcanal and he didn't he's not here back, but he didn't have all this thing. So, you know, that it was a little bit embarrassing, but that's just a personal thing.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I have many more questions to ask Ed Nacy. We have not discussed his participation in one of the most famous days in world history, and probably the blackest that the sky has ever been over the coast of France. We're going to get to that when we come back. It's Hometown Heroes on KMJ. Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Los Banos at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Los Banos every once in a while. So next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common: Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Los Banos.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes here at Castle Air Museum in Atwater, California. Not too far off the 99. If you're heading north, south, make sure you take a detour into Atwater and visit these great old airplanes on display. And you'll talk to people who know a thing or two about them. Maybe if you've taken a tour at Castle Air Museum over the years, you've had Ed Nacy as your tour guide. Today, he's our guest on Hometown Heroes. 89 years old, but still some sharp memories from his days in B-24s in World War II. And a couple things come to mind here, Ed. I know we're going to hear about D-Day. I want to ask you about coming home from the war. But another thing that comes to mind, guys who served on bomber crews. Everybody seems to have at least one good story of the name of an airplane or some pretty good nose art that was on one of those airplanes. Did you ever get to partake in dubbing one of the planes you flew on?
No, I did not. No, we were combat crew replacement crews, and we, when we got there from Ireland over to the base there in New East Anglia, they took the airplane away from us. We never saw it again, and then we were just a crew that got whatever airplane came up next when the mission was assigned. So we went and flew that airplane. So you didn't specifically identify with a specific B-24.
So you rarely flew the same one twice.
That is correct, yeah.
Did you have a favorite, though? Did you walk up to one someday, see what was on the nose, and say, okay, this is going to be a good mission today?
No. No, I never had that. No, everything happened so fast. You know, as I say, we were flying almost every other day. I never really identified with a specific. You had the mission, and you had to have your flight plan and get all the information, all the communication, and all that sort of thing. Get your position and stuff, and get in the airplane. And as they say, you had to move pretty fast and stuff. That's the extent of that.
And you were a navigator with the 328th Squadron, the 93rd Bomb Group. People have heard pilots who are most of the time in control of the airplane. The bombardier takes over control of the airplane when you're going in to drop your bombs. What does a navigator do, and what was the toughest thing about being a navigator?
Well, I guess D-Day was probably the most responsible mission in a way, because as I said, there was 11,000 airplanes in the air, and they had a very complicated control way of controlling traffic. So you had to be. We took off, and we didn't always take off at night, but in this case, we did. We took off at about 2 o'clock in the morning, at 1 o'clock, and the job we had was to follow the airplane ahead, where they had tail gunner was blinking an Aldous lamp, and we had to follow him. As it turned out, in many missions, weather was always a problem. And so it hardly ever did a mission go as planned. Rare. And so climbing out to get up to altitude was dangerous, hazardous. And so you had to be watching for that. But we had to follow then a fixed route and follow that at a fixed altitude. And that was controlled. So we went all the way north up into Scotland and stuff, because they had to pace the control of traffic and stuff. So we had to go up there, and we had to have a precise control time to be there. So that was the most important thing. And when we got to that control point, we had to watch for the Pathfinder aircraft that had the radar. And so they had a whole group that assembled over that Pathfinder aircraft. And then we followed them down to the beaches to control the pattern of the bombs on the ground. The idea was that everybody in that particular formation dropped the bombs at the same time as the lead aircraft with radar and stuff dropped the bombs. So that's what we did. And we dropped exactly at 6 o'clock in the morning on the beaches at Normandy. And the thing that was scary about it was the concern. Here we are, we got a load of bombs and so forth, and underneath us, it was bad weather. You couldn't see them, but you knew they were there. And so the concern that there would be an accident or a drop or something, unfortunately, a drop short of bomb or anything like that, that was the most harrowing part of that mission.
The concern that you would bomb your own forces?
Yeah, as it was, it didn't happen in that case, but we didn't have any problems with fighters. No problems at all. We returned back to our base, and we then stood by for several hours to have to go back again and do it again. But as it turned out, we didn't have to go back. But that was probably the biggest concern of the D-Day mission.
Well, and we've all seen the pictures of June 6, 1944, from the ground and from the air. But What did it look like to you, and have you ever seen anything close to that the rest of your life?
No, nothing that big. That was the big one, yeah. So, yeah.
Describe it for us from your spot in the nose of that B-24. If you looked up to the left, to the right, what did you see?
I saw the airplanes in our formation. We didn't see much below, but we saw our own group and stuff. When we saw the lead ship, when they were going to drop their bombs, and of course we had set up all the rack switches and the controls and that sort of thing, so we'd be able to drop precisely at the same time as they did. So our bombs would fall in that same pattern. It was a question of timing; had to be very precise and that sort of thing. So we were alert and tense, doing everything right. So
was it? Would you say awe-inspiring to see so many airplanes in the sky all participating in this coordinated effort?
Oh, absolutely. 11,000 airplanes is, it's a little bit overwhelming and stuff to even realize and stuff. And then, of course, when you after it's over you look back and see the control traffic and stuff, of the danger of trying to, and the challenge of trying to assemble all these airplanes to get to a specific target area on time, and do as supposed to go, while the whole all the rest of the operation going on. It's really how do you describe it? It's a planning and execution of that complicated invasion, and all the people and all the equipment and all the crews and stuff involved were unbelievable, even now looking back on it.
And you can say that with the perspective of 32 years in the military behind you, not to mention all the years after that out here at Castle Air Museum volunteering your time. I want to ask you, I know we're bouncing around a little bit here, but you told us earlier about the mission where your plane was shot up, people were wounded, and after that you were able to come home. What was it like to get back home, to see your family again, and describe that reunion for us if you can?
Back to home to Duluth? Yeah. Oh, it was a happy time, obviously, and about 2 weeks leave time and so forth. But I think I even went to a football game there, in that because it was in September and stuff. I just waiting then to see what the next mission was going to be, and from there I went back to through processing again to your next assignment and that sort of thing. But I knew that it was headed my way towards the Pacific, and as it turned out, I was sent to the transport division of the Pacific Division, and then I started flying as a navigator with the transport groups, C-54s from California to Hawaii to Kwajalein and so forth, to support the operations and stuff. So did that for several time missions and so forth. And then ultimately, the group that I was with was assigned the job of taking the occupation troops into Japan when the war ended, after the atomic bomb, and they said, well, the war's going to, somebody has to take the occupation troops into Japan. As it turned out, it was my group, and so we flew to Okinawa to pick up the occupation troops, and from there we then flew them into Atsugi, which is outside of Tokyo, and this was about 10 days, 8 or 9 or 10 days after the war ended. The interesting thing to me was the fact that we were able to go into Tokyo on the train, and the train was still working. I've told this story many times, but I'll tell it again. Getting on the train, it was jammed and so forth, and I remember there was a little Japanese kid that got banged up in the crowd in Russia and stuff, and he had hurt his lips, and he had bloody lips and stuff, and I can still see those bloody lips and stuff, and I gave him a candy bar, and he gave me this big grin. So that still sticks in my memory. But we went into Tokyo and spent a few hours there, and then came back to Atsugi, and then back to Okinawa, and then back home. So that is still kind of remarkable, the fact that we could go into, after we'd been bombing these people and so forth, and to be able to go in there and on their train that was still operating. We didn't carry any arms or anything. We're just as helpless as anybody, but they just kind of gave you the bow and accepted the fate, I guess.
Was it significant to you and the guys with you when you heard about the bombs being dropped and when you heard shortly thereafter that the war was over?
Yes, very, very significant, yeah. So, but I'd already kind of, I liked what I was doing, and I liked the Air Force and stuff, so I'd already kind of decided I was going to stay on for a while. So I continued flying as a navigator with the transport group, and then I volunteered. They were asking for volunteers to go into Shanghai and to set up the navigation routes for the post-war operation there. So that's what I did, and I went to Shanghai, China for four or five months in January 46 and on there for several months. And when in the process of doing that, we flew, established the navigation routes and the missions for all those bases in there, and you know, Formosa and in Tokyo and Peking and all those bases, and established the routes and stuff there. So yeah, and so there was some wonderful stories on that one. And yeah, I don't know how much time we've got, but I could tell you one. You know, the flew into Formosa. We were in a C-54, and there was Formosa was mostly Japanese were still there, and we were just one crew. There's millions of million people in Tohoku there, and it's now Taipei and stuff. But the Japanese were still there, and I bought a camera from a Japanese soldier that was there. And when I got back home, I developed the film in the camera, and it had his platoon there. And so that was one thing. And the other thing, so the Japanese that were there were being redeployed, and they couldn't take anything with them, so they offered us their sword. But we're young and stupid now, maybe. But we didn't accept them and stuff. But it was an interesting experience in Shanghai and stuff.
Well, most of the guys that I've interviewed, I mean, there are some exceptions, but most of the guys I talked to, once World War II was over, they were happy to be out of the service. But you decided to stay in and stayed in for 32 years. Why was that? Why did you enjoy the Air Force so much?
I just liked what we're doing and so forth. And as it turned out, I knew the next things were coming on. And then it was next thing was into from transport into the Strategic Air Command. And I spent 15 years in Strategic Air Command in various airplanes, the B-29 and B-36 and B-52 and all of those in Rapid City, South Dakota and stuff. So SAC was a wonderful command, actually. The difference between Strategic Air Command and all the previous operations was very, very noticeable. SAC was a disciplined, organized, planned, well-run organization, and the rest of the operation was just still learning, and so forth. But that was SAC was a you know their motto was peace is our profession, and we lost a lot of airplanes though in SAC, but we kind of believed in that mission, and it was in hindsight now it was successful. I think you know
the Cold War.
Cold War did find the end. Yeah.
Of course, we talked about your days in B-24s in World War II, and you just mentioned three other aircraft that you flew on in the B-29, the B-36, and the B-52. I guess that all made you eminently qualified to be a tour guide here at Castle Air Museum, huh? How'd they rope you into that?
I would think so, yeah. As a matter of fact, I love doing it and stuff. Unfortunately, when you get older, and I have some breathing problems and so forth, and I found out I couldn't quite keep up with it, but I regretted that I couldn't do it. But I used to still do it, and we'd go in stages. I'd go take people for about halfway, and then rest for a while, and another halfway and rest. So, but it was still it was a rewarding experience to take people on those tours.
What did you get out of that? I mean, and maybe do you have a memory or two in your mind of a tour that you gave and the way someone reacted, or you saw the light bulb go off in someone's head, or you just saw someone come alive because of these aircraft and the stories you were able to tell about them?
Well, I think two things in regard to that. You know, wonderful with the kids, telling the kids and so forth. They were interested and they had a surface interest. They didn't get in any depth. But then when you had the adults and the more senior adults, the typical thing was, they wanted to tell you their experiences. And so that was kind of normal. So, and I think maybe it's natural. Everybody wants to tell you about their experiences and stuff. So, but tour guiding was a very satisfying thing. I enjoyed it.
I think it's true for a lot of us that we often don't appreciate the things that are right under our nose. We seem to take them for granted, and maybe some people feel that way about Castle Air Museum. What do you appreciate about this place, and why is it important to you that Castle Air Museum lives on and continues to be a valuable resource for people here in the Valley?
Oh, yeah, no doubt about that. The Castle Museum is my baby. I've flown in 14 of those airplanes that we have out there. I've flown in them and so forth, and I have memories associated with each of those airplanes. And so when we have open cockpit, I love taking the people through the B-36 because this is a really, it's a rare, rare thing. And when we get the kids in there, you know, and the kids will come through there, and I always tell them, when you go to show and tell next day in school, you tell everybody you're in the only 10-engine airplane in the world, and it's the only one like it. And you tell all the rest of those kids that and stuff. And so that was fun doing that, yeah.
For people that haven't been here or haven't experienced everything that Castle Air Museum is, what would you tell them? Why would you tell them that they ought to get over here?
Well, you'll see a wonderful collection of airplanes, and there's pieces of history associated with every one of those airplanes. And if you're lucky and have a good tour guide and stuff, and somebody that has personal experience in those things, they can narrate the whole story of that airplane and that sort of thing, and what the experiences they had in that airplane. So,
well, you know, the reason that I do this show and have been doing it for a while is to preserve history, and because you're the only person that can tell us your story. And when guys like you are gone, do you feel like some of your history will live on because this place is here and because those aircraft have stories to tell, and that the time that people like you have put in here have preserved some of that? Is that a fair statement to make?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it worries me sometimes that something could happen that it wouldn't finish. But this is a treasure here in Atwater and in California. And we tell everybody the best museum west of the Mississippi, but I think it's even better than that. So, and I had people, visitors from Scandinavia and England, and a lot of other places would come through when I was a tour guide, and they'd say, we've been to all those other museums where the airplanes are kind of inside a building, mm-hmm. and you can't get any good pictures of an airplane in its natural environment. Mm-hmm. But here at Castle, you can. So it's the best museum for taking pictures of airplanes in their natural environment, I think, in America. Even and the one in Washington, D.C., it's almost impossible to get a picture of a specific airplane because all the other planes are crowded around it.
Wright Patterson, eat your heart out, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Ed, we're just about out of time on the program, but I want to thank you for serving our country and for all your hours and years that you've given to us here in the Valley as well. Is there anything else that you want to share with our listeners that you think they ought to know about World War II or the Air Force or anything that you've done?
No, I just keep on flying. That's what I tell when I, Christmas cards is something I say, my other friends are 89 and 90 and 91, I say, just keep flying. Uh-huh.
Well, I think our audience would want to say back to you, keep flying, all right?
Right. Okay.
That is Ed Nacy, 89 years old, a recipient of the Distinguished Flying Cross, and one of the volunteers who has helped make Castle Air Museum a place where history continues to come alive on a daily basis. I think it's the perfect place to close out 2011 with Hometown Heroes. Check out the links online at kmjnow.com to learn more about Castle Air Museum. And we'll start 2012 here, too. Another longtime volunteer at the museum, Bill Hiller, joins us next Saturday. Happy New Year to you. I look forward to sharing more of these veterans' visits with you in 2012. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes on KMJ.